The Tom Woods Show, episode 1840.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. We are wrapping up Scott Horton Week. I know I have a tear in my eye also. We're wrapping up Scott Horton Week with this episode. And just when you think, doggone it, Scott Horton Week couldn't get any more controversial. Well, we're hitting you over the head with the truth about the Iran nuclear program and what that's been all about for years and years. Make sure you go out and you don't just listen to these episodes. You go out and get a copy of Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism by our guest, Scott Horton. Give them to your friends. This is the friends you've tried to, you know, beat over the head all these years, or even the friends who kind of agree with you, but, you know, they sure could use some ammunition, so to speak, the good kind. Well, you got it in the form of this book. It's linked on all the show notes pages this week. Today's is tomwoods.com/1840. And once again, and for a final time for Scott Horton Week, I welcome Scott back to the show. Scott, thanks once again for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
All right, let's dig right into this. It seems like as long as any of us can remember, it's almost a joke at this point. We've heard somebody, some political leader saying the Iranians are on the verge of making a bomb, and it's months away, it's weeks away. And then when you look at the date, it seems ridiculous. I mean, I don't know how long ago was the first time they said it was months away, but it's decades at this point. So we really need you to talk about what's really been going on. And then secondarily, to answer the claim, isn't it just naive to take the Iranians at face value when they say, oh, a program like this would be against our religious values. We just want nuclear power for peaceful purposes. You know, there are plenty of hawks out there who say, yeah, sure. So, Scott, I want you to unpack this for us. Help us out.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't believe any politicians, and especially not politicians from some foreign country like Iran, which is completely alien to me, and I don't even speak the language. I don't even know what the guy's saying. I only know what somebody said he said, and I definitely have no reason to trust that. And not only that, but the guy's a supreme ayatollah at the same time that he's the supreme leader of a nation state. Well, that makes him a theocrat, which I think makes his word even less honest than I would have taken it anyway. So I have no reason whatsoever. And no one that I can think of has any reason whatsoever to take the ayatollah at his word other than his subordinates. And that's where the rubber meets the road, is that all this time since the 1980s, the Ayatollah Khomeini and now the Ayatollah Khamenei have both said that this is haram. Religion forbids it. We can't do it. And I'm not saying, again, that I believe that they really think that. I'm just telling you that they said that, and all indications, and there are no real indications otherwise, all indications say that the government has obeyed those edicts. That's it. When the supreme leader says it would be haram for us to act like Saddam Hussein and make chemical weapons or nuclear weapons, try to make nuclear weapons, and that's it. They don't do it. And that was what happened in the 1980s at the height of when Saddam Hussein was using sarin and tabin nerve gas that he got from the Germans and the French, and I guess something he had made himself, all of it paid for by the U.S., and targeted at the Iranian teenage conscripts with Ronald Reagan's military satellites and all of the information, you know, all the intelligence from the satellites provided to Saddam Hussein to use against them. And then when the Ayatollah's men came to him and said, hey, we need to fight back against this stuff. And by the way, kind of already got some chemical precursors ready to go here, you know, as soon as you give us the order here, Ayatollah. He said, no, it's forbidden. He said, your only thing that you're allowed to do as far as these efforts are make, you know, defensive prep, like in other words, antidotes and whatever, methods for treatment of the victims of it. You're not allowed to respond in kind against Saddam Hussein, or else how am I better than Saddam Hussein, is what he's reported to have said. And that's the great Gareth Porter, who went to Iran and talked to all of the guys who worked for Khomeini back then in the 80s about this, and also reported that the latest Ayatollah, and there's plenty of evidence other than just Gareth Porter says so, of course, he's the best. It's when the Ayatollah said no to nukes in foreignpolicy.com. But Khamenei has said the same thing.
But can I jump in on this? Because I was just reading a news item that I think people will throw at you. It's by Reuters. And here's the first sentence. Iran's intelligence minister said persistent Western pressure could push Tehran to fight back like a, quote, cornered cat and seek nuclear weapons, which the Islamic Republic has for years insisted it has no intention of ever developing. Now, I know that we could make a case for if any country feels like it's a cornered cat and is being put upon by outside forces, it might want to develop nuclear weapons. But when they specifically said, we have religious objections to the very idea, well, then doesn't this throw a little bit of difficulty into your claim?
Well, I mean, again, I'm just saying that that was what they said, not necessarily what they meant. And they could turn right around and say, actually, now that I reread the Hadiths, it says here we can defend ourselves by any means necessary. I don't know. I'm just saying that is the state of the fatwa up until now, you know, and I'll elaborate on this a little bit more further, you know, about what I really think, you know, their program is meant to do. Well, I guess I'll get into that now. I mean, I think the point of it is this. They have a civilian program. And, you know, to change the subject from just what the Ayatollah said to the reality of the situation here, they have a civilian program, but they are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty since 68. So every part of their civilian nuclear program is safeguarded by the IAEA as per their signature to the NPT. And so they have mastered the fuel cycle. They've shown that they know how to convert uranium ore to yellow cake, you know, semi-refined ore, I guess, which then they have to convert to uranium hexafluoride gas, which is then enriched to separate out the 238 and leave the sweet stuff, the 235, and that you use to make electricity or kill people with. So the thing of it is, they've proven that they can do that. And so I think what that means is that you could put them in the exact same category as Japan, which is that they have a latent nuclear deterrent. They have proven that they know how to enrich uranium, which shows that, yeah, if they wanted to, they could enrich up to weapons grade, which really needs to be about 90% purity. I mean, Hiroshima was about 80-something percent, 235, but typically a uranium bomb would be above 90% purity of 235. And they're showing that they could do that, and so don't mess with them, right? I'm carrying a handgun, and I got a pocket full of bullets. Now, why are you going to try to provoke me into putting bullets in my handgun here when we were just standing around? Right? That's the message. And when Bush declared that Iran was part of the axis of evil with Iraq and North Korea, the Iranians' reaction to that was essentially, well, they wanted to help steer us into Iraq anyway. We've talked about that. But as far as their nuclear program goes, they said, hey, our hands are up and our books are wide open. Don't shoot. You can't shoot. Look at how high in the air my hands are. Look at how wide open my books are. You guys have access to all of our uranium stockpile, all of our conversion facilities. You know, the law is under the NPT or under the safeguards agreement that the IAEA inspectors have jurisdiction anywhere where nuclear material is being introduced in any machine to be changed in any kind of a way. And then also, you know, the final stockpile of whatever they've got. And so their bet was that if they can prove that they really, if you know, prove the negative, they're like, hey, you guys are hither and yon everywhere around here. We don't have a weapons program. That's it. That would keep America from invading. And in fact, that's what happened, Tom. If you'll remember in 2007, in the fall of 2007, the CIA and, as Hillary Clinton liked to lie about Russiagate, the National Intelligence Council, that is all 17 American intelligence agencies that we know about, came together and, you know, agreed and wrote the National Intelligence Estimate of 2007 on Iran's nuclear program, which says that they don't have a nuclear weapons program and they have not made the political decision to turn their civilian nuclear program into a nuclear weapons program. And that's where we stand right now. And according to them, they had done research up until 2003, but Gareth Porter proved in his book, Manufactured Crisis, that even that was not true, that the idea that they had done research in how to make nuclear weapons up until 2003 itself was based on, one, the forged, Israeli forged, supposed Iranian smoking laptop, which is completely debunked. And the chain of custody was traced to Israel through the Mujahideen-e cult, communist terrorist cult. And then the other thing was a group of intercepts by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which they made an honest mistake. They made a judgment that looks to us like they're buying dual use items for some kind of secret nuclear project. But later when the IAEA had jurisdiction to go and look, they resolved all these questions and they said, oh, there's that ring magnet we were looking for. It's right here at Sharif University for the civilian purpose it was claimed to be for in the first place. And then the few other examples, and the IAEA resolved that Those dual use items were for their innocent civilian purpose. It was not part of a secret project to build a bomb. Even though, as Garris says, the DIA didn't seem to be lying. They were making their best guess estimate that, like, hey, it looks like something suspicious here, boss, kind of a thing. But it turned out to not be true. And that's the only thing that the accusation that they were even researching how to make nuclear weapons up until 2003 was based on. But then, Tom, it's in George W. Bush's memoirs. And I quote it in the new book that he talks about essentially crawling on his belly before the Saudi king and begging His Majesty's forgiveness because the CIA really screwed him on this by telling the truth. And then he complains to the reader, how was I supposed to launch a military action against a country that my own CIA was telling me didn't even have a military nuclear program in the first place? God dang it. So there it is. The CIA stopped the war by telling the truth. And George Bush later complained, man, if they hadn't told the truth, I would have been able to start the war I wanted to start. Blast them.
But isn't that weird, Scott, that isn't this the same CIA? Like, aren't these the same intelligence people who screwed up Iraq so badly? I mean, how do we account for that?
Well, I think that's the answer, right? Is they mostly screwed up Iraq, and they certainly tortured al-Libi and Zubaydah into pretending Saddam was friends with Osama. And they lied about many of the aspects of the weapons of mass destruction case. But at the same time, though, that parade into Iraq War II was being led by Bush and Cheney and their neoconservatives. And the CIA was along for the ride. Cheney and Libby made 14 visits out to CIA to pick on the analysts. You know, hey, nerd, where's my Iraq intelligence? Come on with it. Why are you guys not, you know, giving up the goods that we need so we can launch this war, and really pressuring them? And Newt Gingrich, also, who is a member of the Defense Policy Board with the neoconservatives, would go over to the CIA, the former Speaker of the House, would go over there to the CIA and, you know, pressure them as well. And they did give in. I'm not acquitting them. I'm saying they're guilty. But I'm saying the context here is that, as we discussed before, the neoconservatives over at the Office of Special Plans and at the Policy Counterterrorism Evaluation Group were digging through the CIA's trash, putting together whatever they could that the CIA would not stand by, and anything that they could to spin up a case of weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda. And those were the talking points that really were at the forefront of the White House Iraq group and the rest of the official, you know, public relations push to get us into the war. And then the whole time, when even after all of their lies were being debunked, after the inspectors spent months, the inspectors went back at the end of November, maybe earlier than that, they spent months going to all the sites that the Americans told them to go to, and there's no weapons anywhere. And the whole time that the inspectors couldn't find anything, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the Bush administration kept saying, yeah, but we have the CIA. We have intelligence. And what they say is unimpeachable. We know Saddam's hiding the weapons. How do we know he's still hiding them? Because we know he has them and he's not delivering them. George W. Bush said, we know what it would look like if he decided to tell the truth. He would come and bring the weapons to some parking lot or something and give them up. And he hadn't done that. And that means that he's guilty. And we know it because the CIA says so. Then, as soon as the war began and they couldn't find any of the weapons of mass destruction, they were, well, I guess it's all the CIA's fault. They're the ones who said that they had the weapons, when this whole parade was really led from the top all along, and they were dragged along, invoked as the reason that we all had to believe it, and then blamed for it all when it wasn't really true. And so, you know, again, of course, they are guilty as far as that goes. They lied about the aluminum tubes and, you know, a lot of the things. But to say that George Bush was just sitting around one day and then the CIA came to him and said, oh, no, it's an emergency. Saddam's going to team up with Osama and attack us if we don't stop him first, boss, is a total lie. And in fact, Vincent Bugliosi, who prosecuted Charles Manson, he wrote a book called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, where he says that, look, actually, if you look at what the NIE of 2002 says, it says that the CIA judges that Saddam would never attack the United States with chemical weapons, except perhaps if we were closing in on Baghdad. But an offensive threat that he would give the weapons to Osama bin Laden, they did not judge that at all. And so Vincent Bugliosi said, well, either George W. Bush read that, you know, and then just lied and turned around and said, intelligence says this is a real danger and a real threat we must preempt, or Condoleezza Rice read it and didn't tell him what it said.
You know, if you accept that George W. Bush has about a fourth grade reading level and probably couldn't get through an NIE, his Condoleezza Rice, the way Bill Gliosi put it was, let's indict Rice. And then if she wants to say, no, he read it, then we'll let her go and prosecute him. But that was what it said. The CIA didn't say, oh no, Bush, you better preempt this terrible threat to America. They did say, okay, yeah, they got some chemical weapons somewhere probably. You know what I mean? And then they took the rap. So now it's 2007 and Bush and Cheney are trying to push us into a war with Iran. And then the CIA figures they're going to take the rap for it at the end again. And they decided that no, or maybe it was just revenge. You know what I mean? I don't know. But I'll tell you, it was, oh, you know what? This is part of it, was Thomas Fingar, who was the chair of the National Intelligence Council. He came from the State Department, Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He wasn't CIA. So the National Intelligence Council meant the 17 agencies had to agree. And he knew what the truth was. Fingar wasn't about to toe Dick Cheney's line. They were so pissed that all their intelligence, the State Department's INR, that all their intelligence had been thrown out. All their cautions and all their caveats had all been ignored about the weapons before Iraq War II. And so I think it was Thomas Fingar is the real hero here. And he essentially, I don't know exactly what the CIA was going to do, but they certainly went along with his plan to tell the truth that time.
Hey, everybody, let me just get a word in here to thank our sponsor, Merck Research. I am sure many of you are tired of hearing there's going to be a stock market crash just around the corner every day for the last 10 years. Well, our friends over at Merck Research provide unbiased monthly analysis on the economy and stock market. And through a consistent set of easy-to-read charts and frameworks with written analysis, these monthly reports provide an intellectually consistent view on the market and economy. You can download the PDF chart books with analysis or watch the video voiceover walkthrough. Their goal is to help you better understand what's really going on and ultimately to help you make better investment decisions. Almost all financial media, like all media, has become fear-mongering clickbait. And if you're tired of the nonstop and inaccurate doom and gloom and want an objective and insightful summary of what's going on in the market and economy, go over to tomwoods.com/research for a no-risk 3-month free trial. And it's only $20 a month after that. So for your no-risk 3-month free trial, check it out at tomwoods.com/research. All right. Now let's talk about, I don't know how much there is to say, but I feel like I want to bring things up to date here. How long ago was the first time you're aware of that we heard it said that Iran was not just seeking a nuclear weapon, but was X number of months away? Because I just want to know how ridiculous it is to be still saying it.
Okay, the first one that I know of is Shimon Peres in 1992.
Okay, so almost 30 years.
Right. And the first time Netanyahu said it was in 95. And then, I don't know if you remember this, Tom, from Iraq War II, they called it the Friedman Unit because Thomas Friedman would always say, you know, the next 6 months here are going to be crucial and decide whether things work out or not. You know, and he would always just kick the can down the road another 6 months. And they go, oh, it's a Friedman unit, the 6 months. This is one of the things that they invoke all the time. A month away, 6 months away, a year away, and then, you know, or less. And then as Tony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, said, last week, that they're just weeks away from a nuclear weapon. Okay, so this just isn't true. I can explain all this. It's a lie, and it's a lie cooked up in Tel Aviv because they have a policy since the early 90s that they don't like the Ayatollah anymore. You know, they didn't break up with the Ayatollah after the Iranian Revolution. They backed Iran the whole time America backed Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War. But then they turned their policy around. It's pretty complicated, but they had what was called the periphery policy or the doctrine of the periphery that said we want to back Turkey and Iran and Ethiopia and countries like that to keep all our close-in Arab states off balance and divided by enemies on their far side kind of a thing. And then what happened was Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres was his right-hand man, I guess, was his president at the time or defense minister, I guess, when he was prime minister. And they changed the doctrine of the periphery and turned it upside down and said, no, in fact, now we want to go ahead and negotiate with the Arabs. I mean, they'd already made peace with Egypt and Syria. They said, we want to negotiate with the other Arab states, or at least some of them, and including the Palestinians. He was not really going to give them an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza. That much was a ruse, although he was assassinated by a Zionist settler, you know, Netanyahu fan who, you know, to him, it was all the same. To him, it was the greatest betrayal. So he murdered him over it. But it's not like he was really going to give up an independent state, but he was negotiating with the Palestinians. And so he came up with this policy of turning around and demonizing Iran, in a sense, in order to distract from the fact that he was going to begin to treat the Palestinians slightly more fairly. That, you know, his critics would say, you know, oh, you're a traitor and a sellout and you're giving up the West Bank. And he would say, what about the Ayatollah? Right. But then after he was assassinated, then every Israeli prime minister since then has been determined to not give up any of the West Bank and Gaza. They keep it all for themselves. They would rather have a peace process that lasts from now until the 22nd century and never goes anywhere. You can call it whatever you want. They're stealing that West Bank. And if you say anything about it, they go, what about the Ayatollah? And so they take, you know, what Yitzhak Rabin had done in changing the policy around, but with this more cynical twist on it. And so part of that then is the pretension. And you can find this. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and find an original footnote. I know Scott Ritter writes about this in his book, Target Iran, although he's not the most quotable source these days. But the policy was that for Iran to have any nuclear technology at all is, ready for the magic word, tantamount to them having a nuclear weapon. See, tantamount. You can do anything with tantamount. Wow, what a great word. This is tantamount to that. Why? Because I say so. And then that's it. And then I'll tell you what your policy is based on that too. And then, so the idea is, I guess, that, you know, Truman made this mistake with the Soviet Union and Johnson made this mistake with the Chinese. And we will not make the mistake of allowing this country to get nukes before we nuke them first, before we go to war against them and prevent them from getting one, because Israel says so. And so even when the Americans sat back and let China get nukes, I mean, obviously if they'd invaded, then they'd had a fight with the Russians to deal with and everything. But still, the idea is we absolutely must never let Iran possess nuclear weapons at all. And then that becomes the excuse for all of the sanctions and all of the politics that persecute Iran and keep them essentially out of the community of nations or international community or, you know, whatever they want to call it. It keeps them, especially economically, out. And it's important too that the Israelis have this alliance with the Saudis, which also like seeing the Iranians unable to sell their oil to the world. You know, they have their own interests. And as we've talked about, Iraq War II empowered Iran in the region so much that the Saudis are spitting mad about it. And anything that can be done to limit and hem them in the name of nuclear weapons or whatever you got, they'll take it and they'll push really hard for that policy too. And so there's really nobody that speaks for Iran's side of this. And after all, they are ruled by the Supreme Ayatollah, who is in part a cruel dictator and in part a very, very lousy little R Republican. You know, it's not really an outright dictatorship. They do have regular elections and parliaments and houses of this and that, but it's a very flawed republic, although look who's talking when it comes to that kind of thing. But, you know, back to the actual nuclear program itself and what could or couldn't be done with it. The Israelis know good and well. And in fact, in 2007, when the CIA told the truth, Mossad did too. When they were put on the spot, you can read it in Haaretz, that Mossad agrees with the American CIA and National Intelligence Council that they're not making nukes and that they haven't even researched how to make them since 2003. They never had a bomb program to make one ever. That's according to the Mossad themselves. When they're not lying about it, they admit that that's true. So again, the whole thing is safeguard. So what they have then is a stockpile of low-enriched uranium, 3.5 to 3.6% that they use to, you know, convert into fuel rods to run their electricity reactor. Occasionally, they enrich up to 20%, which is sort of a show of force a little bit to show like, yeah, we could go up to 90. But also, it's to make fuel plates, these plates that are targets for their medical isotope reactor that Gerald Ford had built for them in the 1970s. It's in Tehran, and they make, you know how they have radioactive dye to monitor people's endocrine systems or whatever it is, you know, the special tests that they do, and also cancer, radiation for cancer treatment. You know, so they use these medical, it's a medical isotope reactor. So, and then under the JCPOA, the Iran deal of 2015, essentially all they did, Tom, for all the hype, they essentially added some additional protocols to their safeguards agreements. Or safeguards agreement with the IAEA, some, what do they call them? Subsidiary arrangements. And all these mean is they expanded inspections vastly and they put new limits on the program. So now, I forgot the exact numbers, but they cut down, for example, by about one third the number of spinning centrifuges at the Natanz facility. They took the separate uranium centrifuge facility at Fordo and turned it into a research facility only, no production of uranium there. Then they expanded inspections even to their mines and the factories where they make their centrifuges, although I don't know what's the point of that. I guess to keep tabs of the, you can't argue that they have a secret parallel program somewhere because we have a count of all the centrifuges they've made between this period and that period, that kind of deal. And, you know, they poured concrete into the Arak nuclear reactor, so it's completely ruined and could not even conceivably make plutonium waste that could be refined of its impurities to make a plutonium bomb. And they don't even have the facility to refine that ore anyway. You know, even when that thing was running, the Russians would have to come and take the old plutonium out and take it with them back to Russia to reprocess. And so there was a plutonium path to the bomb that they never even had that's even more closed off than it was before. And then, so once Trump broke the deal at Netanyahu's behest, of course, in 2018, the Iranians, this is actually in the deal. They made sure that this was in the deal. America left the deal. America broke the deal, abrogated the deal, violated the deal, ended its participation in the deal. Well, in the deal, it says that Iran, if that happens, they can stop abiding by restrictions in the deal, at least certain ones, you know, in order to get the Americans back in it again. And that's exactly what they've done. So in other words, they have not said, oh yeah, you withdrew from the deal, then we withdrew from the deal. They haven't done that. They've stayed in the deal. Because the deal, by the way, you know, I should explain, is signed with the rest of the UN Security Council powers. So Britain, France, and Germany, and Russia and China, you know, are signatories to the thing. And so Iran still has a deal with them, if not with us. But they have stopped abiding by some restrictions, and they're building up their stockpile of low-enriched uranium. And this is where Tony Blinken gets to play semantics and pretend that he's not just outright lying to you, Tom. Is because he's saying, well, forget weeks. That's an outright lie. Forget that. But some of the rest of them, when they say 6 months or a year or whatever, what they're referring to is what they call breakout time. But the thing is, breakout time is just an arbitrary category, an arbitrary definition that these kooks made up. And it's really quite an unfair one. What they call breakout time is the time that we believe if they were working really hard, it would take for them to get enough weapons-grade uranium to make one bomb. But that's not what it takes to make a bomb. You still got to machine the ore into, or, you know, machine the metal or convert it to metal and then machine that into just the right shape, you know, hemispheres for a gun-type nuke, for the most simple kind of gun-type nuke. If they're going to make an implosion bomb, you're talking far more complicated and years of research in figuring out how they're going to get that to work. You know, that's not ready-made things. The only easy way to set off a nuke is a gun-type nuke, which is also huge and extremely difficult to deliver for a country like Iran. I guess I could put it in the belly of an airliner and try to pretend to be a civilian flight or something. I don't know how they could get it. Strap it to the back of a flatbed truck. And then, of course, everybody knows that a year, Tom, is plenty of time for America and Israel to carpet bomb not just Natanz and Fordo, but Tehran too, if it came down to that. And they've sworn over and over they would. You know, I'm always talking about that quote from Barack Obama where he tells Jeffrey Goldberg that, yeah, you're right, Jeffrey Goldberg, overthrowing Assad would be a great way to hurt Iran, you know, in the Atlantic magazine in 2012. That's why we're supporting Al-Qaeda there. Okay, I'm paraphrasing. But that article, that comes from an article that's titled, As President, I Don't Bluff. And the whole purpose of the interview, actually, is Obama begging Jeffrey Goldberg to tell Israel for him that he promises, and he really, really, really means it, that he's not trying to help Iran get a bomb here, despite what you may have heard in right-wing media. He's trying to preclude them from ever getting a bomb by locking down their program double than ever before. And like I say, it's completely unnecessary. They already had a safeguards agreement with
the IAEA. And as Mohammed El-Baradei said for, 12 years straight or something, we have continued to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. We see no evidence or indication of any military activity of a nuclear nature going on in this country whatsoever. It just ain't so. So in other words, and the way I try to describe the sort of a like a Mexican standoff sort of a deal a little bit, I guess, in the way I try to describe it in the book, is the deal is they're saying that, look, we'll never make a nuke, so don't bomb us. But if you do bomb us, then we'll probably make a nuke. And so that's why not to bomb us. Because in fact, America doesn't have what it takes to invade Persia and conquer it and change the regime and all of these things. It ain't 53 anymore, and it ain't 2003, and Iran ain't Iraq. And so that's off the table. So if we start a war with them over a civilian nuclear program, then they'll turn it into a weapons program, I think is, you know, what's really going on there. And that quote, I saw that quote that you mentioned about the cornered cat and all that. And I would say that, you know, if you look at that carefully, it's a pretty abstract situation the guy's describing. He's not saying that we're talking about making a change in our decisions at this time or any kind of thing like that. It's, you know, tough guys say lots of things, but I don't think that that particular guy is in the chain of command for deciding whether they're making bombs or not. That is always going to be a decision that comes from way above him on the pay grade there. So, you know, there's a lot of Americans who talk really tough about Iran too. They're not always speaking for President Trump or for President Biden either. You know what I mean?
Well, I appreciate your analysis of all this and sorting it all out, because this whole issue goes back so far. Again, it's like, to me, it's like the Kennedy assassination. There's so many details to master. I'm glad Scott Horton is mastering them for me. Now, having said that, I want to give you an opportunity as we wrap up Scott Horton Week to say a couple things that we want to say that are very important, one about your video series and the other about the Libertarian Institute. So go ahead and take a couple minutes to do that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Tom, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and doing so much to help promote the book. And for that matter, for being part of the Libertarian Institute with us and everything. I think you already know how grateful I am, but I should say it where other people can hear it sometimes too. So there's that. And then, yeah, the Institute, we're holding a big fund drive. And it's been since the summer of 2019 when you helped me do that gigantic fund drive that we did that helped fund the Institute for the last year and a half. Now that money's gone. And I didn't hold any new fundraisers because I didn't want people to think like I'm some kind of grifter. I'm holding another fundraiser before the book that I promised was done yet. And so I spent us pretty much down all the way to the bottom of the bank here in paying my guys and keeping the Institute going. So we need a refresher there. And hey, it's a great time since there's so many new Bitcoin millionaires in the libertarian movement and GameStop ones too, I bet. And, you know, I think at the Libertarian Institute, we got a lot to offer and we've got a great future ahead. Obviously, Cato and Mises are giants, but I believe that the Libertarian Institute is already of an equal stature with some of our other favorite libertarian think tanks, you know. And I think that, you know, with the likes of Pete Quinones and Kyle Anzalone and Keith Knight and all the great guys that we have over there, Tommy Salmons and all our great writers, I think the Libertarian Institute is going to be an extremely important part of our movement for a long time to come here. And I hope if people agree that they'll help keep us going as far as that goes. And then there's the video series, which goes along with the book. Oh, and I should say about the Institute, I'm proud to say we publish books, really great books. Three of mine, The Great Ron Paul, and of course, Fool's Errand About Afghanistan, and the brand new one, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, which is available in Kindle and paperback. And also, if you go to enoughalreadybook.net, or libertarianinstitute.org/enoughalready, you'll see there's about 7 or 8 different options for people who don't want to shop amazon.com. We got all different places where you can get the book there too. And then as part of this, and I want to remind people again, this is a book I was going to write with Tom that turned into a book about Afghanistan a few years ago, but now is finally done and is more or less pretty much what we had in mind when Tom first called me and proposed this thing, that it's a take on each and every one of the terror wars from Jimmy Carter all the way through right now. Not so much for dummies, but for people who are interested in this stuff and want to take a look at that. And yes, including Somalia and Mali and all of them. It's all in there. And then there's this wonderful guy, friend of Tom Woods, friend of the Tom Woods, formerly Facebook group, but now it's on MeWe, I guess, Gus Cantavero, who is this extremely talented video editor. He makes documentaries and television commercials and this kind of thing. And he just volunteered his services to me. And he came over here and filmed me on one day. We knocked out 14 chapters of the video adaptation of this book, Enough Already. And we're putting them out as a regular series on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. And we're putting them out every other day. And so we should be done with the last chapter, chapter 14, on February the 26th. But it's all the way through, Jimmy Carter all the way through. And so far, they've gotten a lot of clicks and a lot of likes. Everybody on Twitter seems to really get a kick out of them and everything. And so I hope people take a look at that. And maybe that'll whet your appetite for the book a little bit, too, if you take a look. It's Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, a video adaptation by Gus Cantavero.
All right. In fact, I'll put that link to the videos at tomwoods.com/1840. So that'll be a quick way for you to find it. I'm going to watch them myself in the coming week and then maybe say something about them in the next Tom Woods Show episode when it's just going to be me. So in any case, Scott, first of all, I also want to thank you. I mean, this is a considerable investment of your time, both the writing of the book and spending an entire week of Tom Woods Show episodes with us. We appreciate that a lot. And all I can say is best of luck to you. And the homework assignment of everybody listening is to go and get Enough Already. I know you think, oh, we have a lot of books to read and this and that. Okay, it's true. We have a lot of excellent books. No question about that. And sometimes I think, I don't think our problem as a movement is a lack of books. Like, we need more books. But this one, I make an exception. This one we did need because there is no such book. If you can find anything anywhere that's like this book in the libertarian movement or anywhere, I'd like to know about it because I'm pretty certain that Scott has done something that hasn't been done that fills a major gap as only he can fill it. So you'll find the links. You know, Scott told you how to find it. I've also got it linked to tomwoods.com/1840. And I hope you all will go do that. And Scott, I hope you have a wonderful night. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. That was Scott Horton Week. I have nothing else to say. Sometimes I wrap things up with a few little comments I do have one more thing to tell you. And that is, I'm doing an event out in California. And you may think, event in California? How can this be, Woods? Well, I don't know. I don't know how this is working. I'm just responding to people saying I got to come out there. So I have an event, San Juan Capistrano, not far from Irvine. March 2nd would have been Murray Rothbard's 95th birthday. We're going to have a wonderful event with a lot of fun folks. We're more than half full already, still with plenty of time to go. So make sure and reserve your spot there because there really is a capacity limit. So the link for the event is tomwoods.com/marktom. That's M-A-R-K, Tom, because Mark Skousen will be joining me there as well. So I hope to see all you Californians there, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.